this week's 51%, women may have been responsible for this in early America.
I've always wondered, you know, were colonists always a little bit tipsy?
Meet a nonprofit founder whose aim is to help women in poverty, and hear from a singer-songwriter who's been filling up her tour date calendar. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%.
Make it another old-fashioned plea. Make it another double old-fashioned plea. Make it for one who...
Distilling spirits somehow made it on the list of jobs dominated by men. But in early America, it was women who produced most of the alcohol. One Virginia scholar has taken a closer look at the kinds of spirits women were making and how their work eventually shifted to men. Allison Quant serves us the story.
Before refrigeration and pasteurization, drinking fruit juice wasn't really a thing.
Fruit juices sort of naturally ferment.
This is Sarah Hand Meacham, a historian at Virginia Commonwealth University. She says in early America, fruit juice just turned into booze.
This actually becomes a problem outside where fruit would fall. So apples would fall or peaches would fall and they would ferment and then the pigs would eat them.
Which led to the problem of drunken pigs roaming plantations and towns. But it wasn't just pigs who were wandering around drunk.
I've always wondered, you know, were colonists always a little bit tipsy?
Colonists drank all day long. Even as little kids, they'd drink ale or cider with breakfast. And in those days, making alcohol was just part of the daily cooking routine, which meant the task fell to women.
So if you look at a cookbook from England from the 17th century or the early 18th century, usually the first one-third of recipes will be for alcoholic beverages.
Women made alcohol for all kinds of purposes beyond everyday drinking.
A lot of these alcoholic recipes were for medicine. Say for toothache or for colds. They would mix alcohol and honey and sometimes ashes from the fireplace to brush their teeth. If you had freckles, you were supposed to use mead, right? A sort of fermented honey to take away your freckles.
Alcohol was used for housekeeping.
They mix it with slugs to cement back together plates. They use gin to clean windows. They add it to blacking to clean fireplaces.
And it served interpersonal purposes as well.
If your husbands lacked energy, you were supposed to take white wine and soak it overnight with hops to give them more vigor.
At the time, alcohol was made in the kitchen.
You would find things like brew tubs and mash tubs in the kitchen or in the dairy, spaces where women could easily check on the contents.
Then something changed. Men left home to fight in the American Revolution.
During the American Revolution, these kind of moving cities, all of these groups of men needed lots of alcohol and they needed it regularly.
The average white man during the war got 7 shots of rum per day.
And he got extra if he helped to dig ditches or if it was raining, and they got double rations right before they went into battle.
So all these soldiers learned to distill liquor in the army camps.
And these men leave the war, go to their homes, and slowly bring that technology into their homes.
Distilling alcohol moves from the kitchen to the barn, and it starts to be seen almost exclusively as men's work. That shift mirrors changes in other fields, like medicine, where we move from relying on women as midwives to men as doctors.
And usually that's a story of technology and also real doubts about women's abilities.
Fortunately, change is once again afoot. Women have solidified a place in the craft distillers market, and early American spirits are making a comeback as well. Meacham says that here in Virginia, distillers are experimenting with early recipes.
They're more effervescent than I expected. They're not especially sweet, and they're really quite good. I didn't expect much initially, but they're really very delicious.
Delicious or not, maybe don't drink them for breakfast. For the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities, I'm Allison Quance.
Leave out the cherry. Leave out the orange. Leave out the bitter. Just make it a straight.
Artesana recently dedicated its new storefront workshop in downtown Holyoke, Massachusetts. The nonprofit was founded more than a year ago to help women living in poverty achieve greater self-sufficiency. 51%'s Paul Tothill spoke with Artesana founder and director Katie Moonen.
Artesana is a social enterprise. We're dedicated to expanding opportunities for women affected by intergenerational poverty. So we're expanding employment opportunities by training and then paying women to weave our products, and then also leadership opportunities and educational opportunities through different programming. And essentially what we do is we collect donations of T-shirts, and we cut those up and turn them into products by weaving them using traditional hand-operated looms. And so it's, you know, a traditional process that people have done all around the world for centuries, weaving out of rags. Basically a way to help cut down on textile waste, because there's over 14 billion tons of textile that goes into the landfill every year from Americans alone. And so this is one small way to reclaim a piece of that and turn it into things that the community needs.
And so what is it that you make out of these discarded T-shirts on the traditional looms?
We make handwoven items specializing mostly in interior decor pieces, so throw pillows, accent pillows, table runners, placemats. We've done rugs, we've done wall tapestries. We do custom projects for folks who need something specific in their home, or even who want to turn their own T-shirts. We just finished making a table runner out of one family, dropped off a bunch of their T-shirts and turned it into table runner, made 100% out of their own T-shirts, for instance. So there's a lot that you can do. But our main activity right now is we have our own collection of interior design stuff that we sell on our online store.
And so I was just going to ask, where can people go and look at your merchandise and maybe make a purchase?
Yes, we warmly invite people to check us out. We're at artesana.co, so www.artesana.co. We have our online store there, a little more information. You can follow us on Instagram with at Artesana Style, and you can find us on Facebook as well.
So when was the beginning? When did you start?
Yeah, so Artesana had its beginnings in a 2013 program for parents that was run in the Holyoke Public Schools in partnership with an organization called Reader to Reader, a literacy nonprofit based in Amherst. And that was my first job out of college. I came here and I went to Smith College in the area and stuck around doing family literacy and adult education programming. And I have an arts background and just started doing different activities with folks in my classes. And I also have always had an interest in ways to disrupt poverty through microfinance and different things like that. And in the back of my mind was the hope that maybe one day the weaving project that we were doing just as part of the adult education stuff could become its own thing and could become a way for people to supplement their incomes or maybe one day really earn a living wage. So through that program, it sort of went through different phases and has evolved to now be its own standalone social enterprise with the name Artesana.
And how many women do you employ there?
Right now, employed are 4 women. They're the ones that are paid to weave our products, and they work anywhere from 10 to 20 hours a week, making anything from, the starting would be 11, but as you're trained and as you become more proficient, you can earn as much as $20 an hour, depending how fast you are. And like I mentioned, always with an eye to how to improve people's personal growth opportunities and people's professional growth. So providing different roles within our operation for people to step into. And that's also another way to increase your earning. And then outside of that, we've also offered free English classes to the community. We have over 50% of the population is Latino, and there's a real shortage of English classes despite this. So we've offered free English classes as well as free creative workshops around fiber arts and different things like that as well. So altogether, we've worked with over 100 women throughout, you know, since 2014 when it became its own project. And currently employed are 4 women, but there's beyond that, you know, more people that we work with through workshops and things like that.
Now, what role did the Holyoke Chamber of Commerce play in this? This came about through an entrepreneurial development initiative that the chamber runs. Am I correct on that?
Yeah, so the Holyoke Chamber of Commerce has started a program called Spark. It's an entrepreneurial program, and as well as different activities. They have a class called the Spark Launch Class, and I was able to participate in that and graduate with just a bit of a deeper understanding of what it takes to start a small business. And that kind of helped crystallize a lot of the forward momentum with Artisana and turn it into, that kind of marked a moment of starting to move towards officially being a social enterprise. So it was really beneficial to work with them. And since that time, they've continued to provide support and just create community around folks starting their own small businesses here in Holyoke.
That was Artesana founder Katie Moonen speaking with 51%'s Paul Tuthill. One of the biggest albums of the 1990s marked its 20th anniversary with a reissue and a tour. Sean Colvin, who has released more than 10 studio albums, celebrated a few small repairs, the smash hit that garnered Grammy Awards for the ubiquitous single Sunny Came Home. After her 2017 album tour in the U.S., Colvin is taking it to Glasgow, Scotland toward the end of January. 51%'s Ian Pickus spoke with Sean Colvin about her 20th anniversary tour and why she decided to do it.
Well, I've always had this idea, not necessarily for the 20th anniversary, but I was kind of inspired by it when Lucinda Williams did like a series of concerts where she did each record one night at a time of hers, and, you know, from top to bottom. And I thought, that's a cool idea. And I always wanted to do it. And I just happened to realize at the beginning of 2017 that it was the 20th year anniversary. So I thought this is a good reason to try it.
What was the process like in terms of getting ready to do the full album through?
Well, I haven't toured with a band in a long time, so The rehearsals for that were obviously a huge part of the process. Also, I wasn't as familiar with some of the songs as I am with others, so there was a learning curve for me. I had to go back and listen to the album a fair amount to relearn some of the tunes.
Now, are you doing another set as part of the show? I mean, you have so many other songs to choose from beyond just this one album.
We're doing some other songs, yeah.
Take us back to writing the album. You were several years into your career. You already had a good amount of success. What was the process like when you wrote this record?
You know, it was surprisingly easy. Maybe the easiest recording process and writing process I've ever had. And I think that's due to a couple of factors, and John Leventhal comes into play here because we co-wrote a lot of it and he produced it. We had each had a few records under our belts, and we had more confidence, and not only we just really did. We had way more confidence. We were kind of freed of the idea, given the fact that I had three records out, of trying to have a hit. You know, it's not like we were trying for it before, but the record company certainly was. So they would pick something on each of those three albums and, you know, and pitch it to radio, to, you know, top 40 radio as well as AAA, but AAA always worked out great. And it didn't really go anywhere for top 40. And by the time I got to a few small repairs, I just thought, well, I'm not going to worry about that anymore. Not that I did a lot initially, but something about that, John and I just had fun. It's kind of anything went, and I was writing more easily and with more confidence. So there was just, I don't know any other word to use, except there was an ease to it where we were just throwing things together and recording even the songs as they came. And it just all came, you know, save for a song or two, like Sunny Came Home, which was kind of a bear. But, most of it was just such a pleasure and a lot of fun, which you can't say for every record that you make.
Sunny came home with the mission. These days go by.
So would you say it was a surprise when the thing started climbing up on the charts and dominating for that year?
Definitely. Yeah, it was a surprise for me. I wasn't even looking for that. And when it started to happen, I was really pretty unaware of it. I was on tour, and I only began to see that something was going on when I was playing Lilith Fair that summer, the summer of 97. And Sonny came home and started to get this big response, you know. And we had it in the middle of the set, and we were like, I guess we better put this at the end, you know. It sounds like a closer. And that was kind of, that was my clue. Even though the record company was probably telling me that it was doing things, I was probably a little dismissive of that. Like, yeah, okay, you know, we'll see. And then something started to happen that I could detect.
How did the success of that particular song and the album and the singles that came after it change your career?
Well, in the short to medium term, it changed it some in that I had a higher profile and I was doing, you know, some higher profile gigs. For example, and a lot of it is just wacky, you know. For example, I was on a Disney Christmas special in Orlando with NSYNC, among others. You know, that kind of thing doesn't happen anymore. You know, stuff like that. I got to be a character on The Simpsons. That was mostly due to a friend of mine. But just fancier things started to happen. But in terms of changing my career, I mean, I was 42. Well, no, I was 42 when I had my daughter. But I was like 40, 41 mm-hmm. when that song hit. And I was kind of well seasoned by then, and I had my niche and I had my style, and it really hasn't changed things, except I had this great experience kind of riding the wave of a hit song, and that was fun. There was nothing wrong with it. And you know, I still just do what I do.
Have you ever gotten sick of having to play that every night?
No, never. That's the beauty of that song and that whole record. It just, you know, and I can't say there's songs that I do that I get sick of from any other record. But, you know, people have asked me that before, like, oh, and, you know, thank God I had a hit with a song that I, you know, didn't compromise on, really am proud of. I have no problem playing it every single night of my life. It's great.
One thing I've read getting ready to speak with you is you've been pushing back a little bit at the notion that this was a, quote, divorce album, even though there are some songs along that theme. How come you haven't taken to that label?
Well, I just think it was a little convenient, you know, like everybody mm-hmm. loves a drama, you know, and I love a divorce record. There's some great ones out there, you know, but I think if you look at the songs, I don't think there's any of them, you know, a lot of them that particularly speak to a breakup. You know, I mean, I think If I Were Brave, it's probably the closest one that deals with the sorrow, you know, of another relationship ending. But people, for example, think Get Out of This House is this angry divorce song, and it's not. And the story I tell about that is that it was actually me with buyer's remorse about buying my first house. And I literally was sitting in that house completely blocked, not knowing what to write. And I just wrote the first three lines and ended with Get Out of This House. And it was truly me wishing that I had never had never bought the house. And then I had to just fill in the blanks. And it was actually a fun song to write and had nothing to do with my husband. You know, at all.
That probably happens a lot, right?
I like to, what, that people think that that's they, what it's about.
You write a song and people hear it and they take a different meaning from what you're saying.
Yeah, they do. And I think that's fine. I think that's that's actually the way it should be, that everybody kind of projects their own, you know, their own emotions onto it and relates it to their own experiences. But this is why I kind of debunk this myth, is because of the divorce record, because then they're thinking about my experience. And I don't, you know, that's not why I do it. That's not why I write the songs. I mean, some of them are very personal, but I just think the hallmark of a good song is one that everybody can have their own interpretation of and relate, you know, be able to relate it to their very own experiences and that time in their life.
So the last time you were on our show, you were talking about your collaboration with Steve Earle. You were on tour together and had done a recording. And we've been talking about the past in this interview, but what are you working on next?
I'm working on a few things. I'm writing songs, and with John Leventhal, we want to make another record. So we've written a few of those. I have an idea for and I'm not going to say a lot about this because I think it'll be a while in the making, but I'm working on what is sort of a theater piece, not a musical to be, you know, performed by other artists, but something that I'm going to do. And then I just finished a follow-up to the Lullaby record that I made in 98. And it's just a continuation of, I took all the arrangements from a particular book that I was given when I was 8 years old, and the lullabies on my past record were all taken from that book, and there were so many left to do that we were approached about making a kid's record, and my initial response was, I don't know what I'd do, and then I remembered that I absolutely adore this book, and there are plenty of lullabies left, so I just finished that. They'll be out in February.
Let's close by hearing her cover of American Tune from 2015's Uncovered.
Many's the time I've been mistaken, and many times confused. Yes, and I've often felt forsaken, and certainly misused. But it's all right, it's all right. Just weary to my bones. Still, you don't expect to be bright and bon vivant so far away from home.
That was Sean Colvin speaking with 51%'s Ian Pickus. She has a busy 2018 in store. As Colvin mentioned, she has a new album being released February 23rd. It's called The Starlighter and adapted from the children's music book Lullabies and Night Songs. And Colvin is teaming up with Lyle Lovett for acoustic performances on the East Coast in March.
And I don't know a soul who's not been battered. I don't have a friend who feels at ease. I don't know a dream that's not been shattered or driven to its knees. Ah, but it's all right. It's all.
And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org and follow us on Twitter at 51% Radio. This week's show is number 1484.